We are starting with the meeting. My name is Cindy Chikonga. First, I think let me welcome all of us who are in this meeting that will be the members of the Portfolio Committee, the Secretariat, Hawks. I can see the leader from Justice Department, media, and any member of the public who is here. You are most welcome to this meeting. First, I think it is important to welcome the members of the Portfolio Committee who are coming from Windsor constituency, but also to mention that during this winter constituency period, for us, two important projects were accomplished. One, it was our UK-Canada trip, which was meant for us to learn from the experiences of the two countries on how they are implementing their DNA legislation. Sitting here, I believe that this was a worthwhile project. I think as the members of the Portfolio Committee, we have a better understanding now on how the legislations on DNA can be implemented and what would be the problems or successes which I think those countries helped us to learn. Another one was our visit to Gauteng Province, in fact, Gauteng Province Police Station, which was last week and the other week. I think it was an opportunity for the Portfolio Committee to actually visit two of the largest police stations in the country, and that is Johannesburg and Pretoria Central Police Station. But also the fact that we were in the province where we believe that most crime occurs, and as such, it accounts for the bigger chunk of the crime that takes place in this country. We learned a lot, we discovered a lot, and we believe that if we meet with the department, or any time we meet the department, we will be talking from experience and from what we saw and not what we hear people say about Gauteng. I think also in this meeting it is important to condemn the continued killing of members of SAPS. I think just last week when we were in Gauteng, we got to know that two members had been killed in different provinces. We believe that any killing of any member of SAPS is extremely wrong. It doesn't mean that the killing of other civilians is not, but we take it that members of SAPS are there to protect us. And when they are killed, it actually means that we remain naked and as such can easily be killed. And that is why we think this should be condemned by all of us. And also call for communities to protect, first to abide by the law, but also to protect and to assist SAPS as they perform their duties. The purpose of the meeting today is to allow Hawks, the Secretariat of the Department of Justice, to brief us on the decision of the Constitutional Court of South Africa in the matter between Glenister and the President, the Minister of Security, of Safety and Security, Minister of Justice, Public Prosecution, as well as Government of the Republic of South Africa. We learnt about this decision on media. We read about it, of course, as we received the decision itself or report on the decision itself. But we believe that it definitely has impact on our work. First, as Parliament, who passed the law but also that established hawks, but also we believe that if there is anything that should be amended in that law or legislation, it has got to come to the portfolio committee or to parliament, whether it's to this portfolio committee or any other portfolio committee, but it has got to come to parliament. And therefore, it is for this reason that we thought we need to get and to be informed as to what the court decision is all about, so that we can set the record straight once and for all. In that regard, I will therefore hand over to the leader of the team, which I think it is a General Dramat. I understand there is also the secretary, the civilian secretary, Jenny Irish Koboshiane, but I also know that we have got other members who, if they feel like, they will introduce to us. But let me hand over to you for the briefing. Can I also mention the fact that even if we're not in Parliament, we did receive the documents for this meeting well on time, and we are appreciating that. I'm mentioning it so that you keep doing this good work, and also you know that when you've done well, we appreciate it. If you've not, we will never hesitate to tell you that no, we don't take this. Over to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair, and members of the committee. We are going to be doing a joint presentation because we have a joint task team that is looking into this issue, so it's not going to be a separate presentation from DPCI and a separate presentation from the Civilian Secretariat for Police. General Dramat will actually take us through the presentation, but maybe beforehand, just to introduce, I'll introduce the Civilian Secretariat for Police delegation, and then General Dramat will introduce his delegation. And what we have done is tried to go through the judgment itself. The presentation focuses on the judgment itself, what came out of the judgment, and then looks at the processes we're involved in. So it doesn't look at what those processes have come up with, because we're still in the process of finalising those, but it looks at what processes are being followed to deal with the judgment. So in introducing the Civilian Secretariat for Police, on my left is Advocate Anton, who has taken over as the head of the Policy and Research Unit. Dr. Polani is also in our Policy and Research Unit, having joined us earlier this year. And Mr. Soman, I think most of you will know, he's the head of our support services, but he's also acting as our legal, until we establish the legal unit in the Secretariat. He's also assisting us on legal matters. Then I'll hand over to General Dramat to introduce his delegation and present the presentation.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The SAPS delegation is Major General Ranto, who is legal services. And next was Dr. Jacobs, Major General, also in the Legal Service Department of SAPS, as well as Major General Aronson. He's with the DPCI. He's part of the task team. Thank you, Chair, and thanks, Secretary, for the introduction. And Johannes from Justice. Thanks. Thank you. Just in summary, the South African Police Service Act and the National Prosecuting Act, both as amended during 2008, effected the closure of the Directorate for Special Operations, DSO, in the National Prosecuting Authority, and the establishment of the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation within the South African Police Service. In the Glenister case, the constitutionality of the said laws has been questioned. The judgment consists of a minority decision, four judges, and a majority decision of five judges. Both the majority and the minority decisions are in agreement that the legislation which created the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation cannot be invalidated on the grounds that it is irrational or that Parliament failed to facilitate public involvement in the legislative process. There was also agreement that Section 179 of the Constitution does not oblige Parliament to locate a specialized corruption fighting unit in the NPA or anywhere else. The creation of a separate corruption fighting unit within the SAPS was not in itself unconstitutional, and the legislative choice to abolish the DSO and to create the DPCI did not in itself offend the Constitution. Two crucial questions were considered by the court. Does the Constitution impose an obligation on the state to establish and maintain an independent body to combat corruption and organized crime? This was answered positively. Does the specialized unit which the impugned legislation has established, the DPCI, meet the requirements of independence? This question was answered in the negative. The legislative provisions establishing the DPCI is constitutionally invalid and suspended the declaration of invalidity in order to give Parliament the opportunity to remedy the constitutional defect within 18 months. The finding was made on 17 March 2011, which means that the new legislation needs to be implemented not later than 17 September 2012. The court found that the Constitution is the primal source for the duty of the state to fight corruption. The Constitution does not contain an express command for the establishment of an anti-corruption fighting unit. The scheme of the Constitution taken as a whole imposes duty upon the state to set up a concrete and effective mechanism to combat corruption. The state's obligation to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill the rights in the Bill of Rights creates a duty to establish an efficient anti-corruption mechanism. The Republic is bound by international law to create an anti-corruption unit with appropriate independence. Reasonableness of such step is of crucial importance. The state must establish an anti-corruption entity with the necessary independence. This is constitutionally enforceable. Sourced from our legislation and from our domesticated international obligations, and is therefore an intrinsic part of the Constitution. On a common sense approach, our law demands the body outside executive control to deal effectively with corruption. It is confirmed that there is no conflict between international law and the Constitution in this regard. The anti-corruption unit must be able to perform its functions effectively without undue influence. Any possibility of individuals abusing the chain of command and hierarchical structure must be limited, and sufficient protection must be provided against any interference in operational decisions regarding the initiation, conducting and finalization of criminal investigations and prosecutions. Full independence not required, but an adequate level of structural and operational autonomy, secure through institutional and legal mechanisms to prevent undue political interference. The appearance or perception of independence plays an important role in evaluating whether independence indeed exists. And I quote, "Hence, if Parliament fails to create an institution that appears from the reasonable standpoint of the public to be independent, it has failed to meet one of the objective benchmarks for independence. This is because public confidence that an institution is independent is a component of, or is constitutive of, its independence." The court concluded that currently the DPCI does not have adequate measures of autonomy. Firstly, it is insufficiently insulated from political influence in terms of its structures and functioning. Secondly, that the condition of service pertaining to members and the head of the DPCI negate autonomy. The court emphasized that the reasonable and informed member of the public may have misgivings over the DPCI's independence. The political oversight the legislation requires over the DPCI was found to be incompatible with adequate independence. Insulation from political accountability is not required, but only insulation from a degree of management by political actors that threatens imminently to stifle the independence independent functioning and operations of the unit. In terms of security of tenure and remuneration, the court requires the members of the DPCI to swear an oath of office or affirmation to perform their duties without fear, favor, or prejudice. The court found that the head of the DPCI and members enjoy little, if any, job security. The DPCI comprises persons appointed by the National Commissioner of the SAPS on the recommendation of the head, plus an adequate number of legal officers and seconded officials. Members are subject to inquiries into their fitness to remain in the service on account of indisposition, ill health, disease, or injury, and on various other grounds. The National Commissioner may discharge a member of the DPCI on account of redundancy or the interests of the service, and even if the discharge will promote efficiency or economy within the SAP. This appears to include the head of the directorate. Members of the directorate enjoy no specially entrenched employment security. No special provisions secure their employment. The court found that the lack of specially entrenched employment security is not calculated to instill confidence in the members of the DPCI. This is exacerbated by the fact that the appointment of the National Commissioner is itself renewable, as opposed to that of the National Director of Public Prosecution. This heightens the risk that the office bearer may be vulnerable to political and other pressures. Absence of specially secured employment may well disincline members of the DPCI from reporting undue influence to the retired judge due to fear of retribution. The head of the Directorate for Special Operations is contrasted with that of the head of the DPCI. The head of the DSO was a deputy NDPP, assigned by the NDPP and reporting to the NDPP. A deputy NDPP may be removed from office only by the president on grounds of misconduct, continued ill health, or incapacity, or if he or she is no longer fit to hold office. Parliament also holds a veto over the office of the NDPP. Parliament must be informed of the reasons for removal and representations and may resolve to restore the deputy NDPP to office. This also applied to the investigating directors in the DSO. The court was of the opinion that these measures in the DSO serve to reduce the possibility of an individual member to be threatened with removal for failing to yield to pressure in a politically unpopular investigation or prosecution. The court found that the absence of secured remuneration levels is indicative of the lower status of the new entity. In terms of the Ministerial Committee, coordination by Cabinet, the Ministerial Committee was the gravest disquiet over the impunity provisions. The Ministerial Committee consists of the Ministers of Police, Finance, Home Affairs, Intelligence and Justice, and any other minister included by the President. The Ministerial Committee is empowered to lay down guidelines in respect of the functioning of the DPCI. The head of the DPCI is accountable to the National Commissioner, whose post lacks security of tenure. Powers of the Ministerial Committee to lay down guidelines for the functioning of the DPCI creates a plain risk of executive and political influence on investigations. The powers of the Ministerial Committee appears to be untrammeled. The legislation does not rule out far-fetched inhibitions of effective anti-corruption activities despite the requirement to submit guidelines to Parliament. The DPCI is not dedicated to anti-corruption only. Matters to be investigated are subject to the discretion of the head, who is subject to the ministerial guidelines. The court did not assume that the power will be abused, but that senior politicians are given the competence to determine the limits, outlines, and contents of the new unit, which is deemed inimical to independence. The Act makes provision for hands-on supervision. In that A, the Ministerial Committee shall oversee the functioning of the Directorate and shall meet as regularly as necessary, but not less than 4 times annually. B, the National Commissioner and the Head of the Directorate shall, upon request of the Ministerial Committee, provide performance and implementation reports to the Ministerial Committee. Requirement of regular meetings and power to request reports creates the possibility of hands-on management, hands-on supervision, and hands-on interference. The power to determine policy guidelines and to oversee the functioning of the DPCI goes much further than ultimate oversight. It lays the ground for an almost inevitable intrusion into the core functions of the new entity by senior politicians, when that intrusion is itself inimical to independence. Parliamentary oversight. 2 points are made. Firstly, the parliamentary oversight the new provisions requires is more benign and less intrusive than that of the Ministerial Committee. Secondly, Parliament's power are insufficient to allow it to rectify the deficiencies of independence that flow from the extensive powers of the Ministerial Committee. This diluted level of oversight, in contrast to the high degree of involvement permitted to the Ministerial Committee in the functioning of the Directorate, cannot restore the level of independence taken at source. The Ministerial Committee and the head of the DPCI have power to determine what the reports to Parliament contain. On other safeguards, the National Commissioner may request prosecutors to assist the DPCI with its investigations. This is deemed as inadequate. Other safeguards to save the new entity from a significant risk of political interest and influence are regarded as inadequate. The complaints mechanism, the judge, acts after the fact. The fact that the National Prosecuting Authority may refuse on reasonable grounds to request for information from the judge is criticized. An ex post facto review, rather than insisting on a structure that ab initio prevents interference, as in our view serious and obvious limitations. In some cases, irreparable harm may have been caused, which judicial review and complaints can do little to remedy. More importantly, many acts of interference may go undetected or unreported and never reach a judicial review or complaints stage. Only adequate mechanisms designed to prevent interference in the first place would ensure that these never happen. In conclusion, Chair, the statutory institution establishing the DPCI derogates the constitutional obligation of Parliament to create an independent anti-corruption entity, which is intrinsic to the Constitution itself, and which Parliament assumed when it approved the relevant international instruments, including the UN Convention. And I quote, the court, do not prescribe to Parliament what the obligation requires. The court concluded that the absence of specially secured conditions of employment, the imposition of oversight by a committee of political executives, and the subordination of the DPCI's power to investigate at the hands of members of the executive who control the DPCI's policy guidelines are inimical to the degree of independence that is required. The court also found that the interpretive admonition in section 17B, B, Roman figure 2 of the SAPS Act, that the DPCI must have the necessary independence to perform its functions, is not sufficient to secure independence. The lack of employment security, including the existence of renewable terms of office and of flexible grounds for dismissal that do not rest on objectively verifiable grounds like misconduct or ill health and absence of statutorily secured remuneration levels are incompatible with adequate independence. Appointment of the members of the DPCI is not sufficiently shielded from political influence. The untrammeled power of the Ministerial Committee to determine policy guidelines in respect of the functioning of the DPCI, as well as for the selection of national priority offences, is incompatible with necessary independence. The power to request prosecutions or prosecutors to join an investigation has limited impact, given that the National Commissioner is the functionary who has the power to request it, and not the DPCI head. Current mechanisms protecting against interference are inadequate, while Parliament's oversight function is undermined by the level of involvement of the Ministerial Committee. The complaint system involving a retired judge regarding past incidents does not afford sufficient protection against future interference. The order of the court, Chair. The constitutional challenge to the National Prosecuting Authority Amendment Act 56 of 2008 and the South African Police Service Amendment Act 57 of 2008 for failure to facilitate public involvement in the legislative process is dismissed. It is declared that Chapter 6A of the South African Police Service Act of 68 of 1995, as amended, is inconsistent with the Constitution and invalid to the extent that it fails to secure an adequate degree of independence for the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation. The declaration of constitutional invalidity is suspended for 18 months in order to give Parliament the opportunity to remedy the defect. In terms of our planning, the internal consultations within the department has commenced some time ago. A draft policy document and bill is being developed jointly by the DPCI and Civilian Secretariat for Police in order to give effect to the findings of the court. The draft documents will form the basis for consultation with other relevant and affected government role players during September 2011. Public consultations will then follow soon thereafter, and Cabinet will be approached during this year in order to be able to introduce the proposed legislation as early as possible during the 2012 parliamentary legislative program. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Just to say one thing, that we would want to have the legislation, the bill, go through Cabinet this year so that it gets tabled in Parliament this year, even if it only gets discussed at the beginning of next year. It must be tabled before the end of this year, of this calendar year, not financial year.
No, thank you very, very much. We are going to allow members to ask clarity-seeking questions with regard to the presentation that has just been made. If there's any Honourable Kolapana, Honourable Annelies.
Thank you, Chair. I wonder if I could just have an explanation on page 12, the first sentence. I've read it a few times. I don't understand. It says, a coordination by the Cabinet Ministerial Committee was the gravest disquiet over the impugned provisions. I can't make sense of the sentence. It was this out of the judgment, or is this an opinion by the ministers? I'm not. It's out of the judgment. Could you put it into English for me, please?
Thank you, Chair. My question is more related to the provisions. I think it's quite clear what the judge's opinion on this was, but there's also a provision in the current Act that allows the minister to review the legislation. Can we get an indication whether the review that you are currently busy as a result of the constitutional of the constitutional outcome also includes that review, because I think it would make sense to do the two at the same time so that we don't have to deal with it at a later stage as well. On the issue of the employment security issue, I know there was, during the process, there was a debate on ring fencing the employees of the DPCI, and it's a debate that obviously wasn't won. Do you consider, would that be a possibility to deal with that part of the complaints or of the findings of the judgment?
While we have all the legal people here, could we have an indication? I see you're busy creating legislation now, which you will present to us in due course. Considering the judgments that came out, which, and having sat for a year through this process previously and warned against exactly every single point that was made here, and while it is absolutely in order for SAPS to establish an anti-corruption unit, absolutely fine, what we are obliged to do is create an independent unit in relation to international law. And obviously a unit within the SAPS cannot be independent. No rank structure could be. So I'm very keen to hear where you're going with the legislation before it proceeds any further.
Maybe I don't believe that we are at the stage where we should be knowing what is in the legislation that you are drafting. I don't believe it is the time for that. And I don't think that this meeting is really meant for that. I think what this meeting is meant for was for us to get clearly as to what the decision was, but maybe to find out as to, in terms of time now, because I think it surely must be possible for all of you to have time frame. We do not want to find ourselves next year, whatever time, rushing time, because the bill is tabled in Parliament in June, and we have to rush again. So I think what we would be requesting you to do is actually to have time frames to say by this time this is going to happen, so that by this time the bill will be in Parliament, will be tabled in Parliament, that can be accommodated in our program. But I don't know whether you want to respond on the question. Do you have a question?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Anuche. I'll try to respond to the issue raised on page 12, which read the coordination by the Cabinet Ministerial Commander of the Gravest of Quiet over the impugned provisions. It is basically a reflection that when the court, it's one of the issues around the independence of the unit, where they were reflecting on the provisions of a ministerial committee in the Act as existed now. And the court was quite critical and spent a lot of time in terms of this ministerial committee and the powers, and to the extent that it impacts on the independence of the unit. Yeah. So.
Just to respond to some of the other issues, the review of the legislation, yes, even before the judgment came out, there were certain things. We had had meetings, for example, with Judge Pillay. There were issues that had come out from that. There had been, I mean, we don't see this legislation that we're going to be bringing before you as purely just a response to the Glenister judgment. We were required to review the legislation, and we're trying to include a lot of the issues that have come up from the DPCI in terms of some of the operational constraints and limitations in that legislation, as well as some of the issues that have been raised with the minister by Judge Pillay himself as the oversight judge. We don't see the legislation that we're going to be presenting as just responding to the Glenister judgment. Just to be clear on the presentation, right up until the last phase, which is the planning, we're referring to what the court said, not necessarily what we're saying, but what the court said. In terms of the employment security issues, I think we are going back through all the issues that were debated in the portfolio committee and looking at some of the issues that came up during the portfolio discussions debate, and not trying to reinvent the wheel from scratch. because there were issues that were raised while it was debated that we would need to take on board. I think that the chair, we wouldn't be able to at this point, because we are still in the process of finalising. There's quite a lot of debate and discussion going on between the Secretariat and SAT firstly, and then it'll have to be discussed with Justice before we can actually provide an answer to Honourable Member Kola Barnard's issue. But in terms of our timelines, we basically intend to have basically finished the policy and draft legislation by the end of September. It will then go to Cabinet in October. There will be some consultations with different departments during October, some of the different stakeholders. It will then go to Cabinet in October so that we need to be able to take it to the first Cabinet meeting so that if there are changes, we can take it to the last Cabinet meeting in October so that it will be able to be tabled in Parliament in November. That's the timelines we want to meet.
Thank you very much, Honourable Ligeto.
Thank you, Chair. I was listening to you attentively. I'm very much concerned that you're not saying anything on the public consultation. And I think those are the other fear, very, very critical. In your response, can you
one of the things, first of all, that we must say is that there are some processes in the process of developing the policy and legislation. We have been engaging already with some aspects in terms of being able to discuss with the academics, some legal experts, etc. around it. However, we see the month of September, the document will be finalised by ourselves by the end of September. But the public consultations will be during the month of September before we take it to Cabinet. But how those public consultations, we need to differentiate between the kind of public consultations that we would hold and the public consultations that the Portfolio Committee will hold. So there will be a slight difference between our public consultations and the public consultations that the Secretariat. I think ours would more be stakeholder and role player consultations as opposed to the Portfolio Committee, which would be much broader public consultations.
And as a matter of fact, the court felt that for the Act now that is in question, there was enough and adequate public consultation, if probably it was also talking to that. And then, of course, when the bill is tabled before us, we'll start our process on the amendment of the bill, in fact, of the Act itself. It will be a process which we'll have to engage on implement here in Parliament. I don't know whether there's any other question. Because I'm just about to attend this meeting for this session. Thank you very much, and thank you for the presentation. We want to thank you, General Dramat and Secretary, for briefing us on this important judgment. I just want to again emphasize the fact that we do not want to be rushed for whatever reason. And we will therefore request that you work within timeline so that if the bill must be tabled in Parliament, they say it has got to be this year so that we can plan properly as the Portfolio Committee, because also some work will have to unfold from our side here in Parliament. And I just want to thank you very much for the presentation. I think we have a better understanding now of the decision itself. And probably can begin to think about what can happen, what cannot happen, and we can talk about it because I think this is in the public domain. I will therefore close this session of the meeting and allow ourselves to go and have tea. I will request the members to come back for a shorter briefing. I think we have a report to adopt. And then we'll close the meeting. Thank you very much. Otherwise, thank you for coming. You can have tea and allow you a few.